And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. So, Patty, we are now talking about the year 1965, and it's as extraordinary of a year as 1964. But one of the things that you said, and I keep laughing about it, but I want you to kind of set the scene for us. You said on the last episode that when the pleasure seekers were gigging at, let's say, private parties or socialite parties or whatever it was at the country clubs, that the parents made you turn down this rock and roll music. Tell us, please, about that. What was, I mean, as you said, you wanted to throw a mic at them, but I mean, doesn't that defeat the purpose of rock and roll?
Of course it does. I mean, when you think about it, we were brought up with my dad's music, da-di-da music, and that was always at a lower volume. So rock isn't meant to be that way. And the kids wanted it blaring. You know, they were used to the Hideout and whatever. I mean, that's what they wanted to hear. And the parents would get a little down, you know. We didn't. I mean, we tried to meet a halfway point, you know, because they were hiring us. But that's not what the kids did. We just had to deal with it. You know, that was our people that were paying us at those Deb things and society dues. You know, we played a lot of teen dances and everything too, where it didn't matter. But those things we had to be more careful.
Well, and again, it paints a really clear picture for me now of this vision that Dave Leone had of wanting to start a teen club for teens where you didn't have parents saying, turn it down, and you could just be raucous while you're rock and rolling.
Yep, absolutely, absolutely.
Well, and the other thing we talked about in the previous episode was this amazing moment of June 1965, because there was a lot that occurred in that month. We talked about your brother bringing out the Rolling Stones the year before in 1964. So if you missed that episode, definitely go back and listen. But in June 1965, the Rolling Stones single Satisfaction came out, and Nan loved it. She was really into the Stones, you said. And so the band learned it immediately. And I just keep giggling to myself. And I said this before, but it bears repeating. The thought of these young, hot girl teens singing, I can't get no satisfaction.
Exactly.
It's fantastic. But also in June of 65, and we touched upon it, but it's pivotal for the group, the Pleasure Seekers, and that's why I want to bring this up. In June of 1965, two of your bandmates, Nan Ball and Diane Baker, graduated from your high school.
Right.
So now they have the summer off. You all have the summer off, but they really have the summer off. First of all, this might seem petty, but was there any question about them leaving the band or staying in the band after graduation, at least initially?
Oh, Nan was gung-ho. She was not going to leave, you know. And by that point, going into the year, Mary Lou and Susie would be in high school with me. And Diane was on the fence. You know, she had her life going on, and she had a boyfriend. And so it was a little different for Diane. She never said she was going to quit, but we knew she was applying to a college, Ferris College, which was further away. So we were aware, you know, it was going to be an issue. We were going to have to find a keyboard player. So I don't think it was overly discussed, because we were doing gigs all through the summer. You know, we were using that time. We were practicing many nights when we could, because it was summertime. Mm-hmm. And that was it. We just kept going, you know.
And you were saying Nan was totally gung-ho.
Gung-ho.
And yeah. Did she apply to University of Michigan, if I'm remembering correctly?
Yes. Yes. She applied. She was going to go there. She figured no problem, no issue. It's an hour drive. You know, she was continuing. And we already had a repertoire drawn up. You know, we must have had, I don't know, 30, 40 songs by then. You know, it just kept escalating as we learned stuff. We learned Satisfaction right away. And, you know, that was it. And we were doing the college circuit by then, too. We were playing at different colleges, their frat parties and stuff. You know, the drunk orgies, you know.
Which I want to get to, by the way. I want to get to those drunk orgies.
Drunk and drunker.
I think that's a given at a frat club or a house or whatever it is. But there, well, speaking of, and maybe I don't know if I'm speaking of, but there is a particular gig you did on July 5th, And you told me that you played with some of your homeboys there, and I'm just kind of being teasing this out a little bit. Do you have any memories, stories of this July 5th gig or a frat party story in general? Hint, Mary Lou.
Yeah, more of the Mary Lou Wildcard thing. You know, that we would be stuck in a frat house, you know, in a corner in the basement, you know, where they were going to have a big room to have the party, and it was jammed always. And so there we were, the audience is like right in front of us. There's no stage, you know, and they're all like bumping us, and you know, they're drunk and moving. Mary Lou would get so pissed, I can't tell you how many times she would hit somebody on the head with her microphone. You know, like Jesus. She was hilarious. She did that. And it
I
happened.
love it. I love it. I love it. I love it. They probably didn't even notice. They were so drunk. And the next day, they're like, why do I have this mic welt in my head?
They were just dancing away, you know, but it was funny. We would laugh our asses off.
I love it. I love it. Well, as great as these stories are, and I want to hear all of them, I think it's important to underscore that for the pleasure seekers in 65, what really began to develop here was that you were honing your musical chops by playing venue after venue, gig after gig, party after party with your homeboys, without your homeboys. And you were talking about even just the year before that you were noodling around and then you started to want to catch up with your homeboys musically. So, talk about what this year meant for you in terms of this invaluable experience.
This is where the Detroit energy came in heavily this year because we, all these bands that we knew and were colleagues with and stuff, they were like from different neighborhoods. They all had their own idea of the sound they wanted to put out. So in jamming, sometimes we would just go to their neighborhood. We would go to Redford and hang with the Nugent Boys and wherever, you know, and you would pick up things. We would jam or we would talk or we'd go to a club, whatever. But it was invaluable, that experience of hanging out with each one in their neighborhood and, you know, getting used to their sound, picking up tricks, you know, jamming. It was an education, yes. It was wonderful. Any given time, we would do that when we were free to do that.
Was there ever a moment where you were not well received when you performed?
No, we were
That's.
really lucky. I can't say that there was. I don't remember that because it was always the novelty of girls playing and still, after we did so many gigs, there was still shock and awe that those are girls playing up there, you know, like duh, you know. So it just carried it. It carried it. And people were appreciative. They dug it. The girls loved it too. So no, I don't remember us not going down.
Fantastic.
Well, you know, yeah.
I love that. Well, so it's now the summer is about to end in 1965. You've been performing all over. You're certainly not done performing. But Nan and Diane, now, two of your bandmates, are ready to go off to college. And for those that don't know the geography, Ann Arbor, as you said, Patty, is about an hour away if you're not on the freeway, about 20, 30 minutes away, if now there's a freeway, but it is an hour away, but it's close enough. And plus, there were places where you could gig out in Ann Arbor. Those mothers, the teen club was there that I believe all of you played at later. So that would be a natural progression for Nan because she could still stay rooted within the pleasure seekers. But you said Diane, though, went off to college and she went further away to Ferris, farther away. And so she, as you have told me, she decided to quit the band. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, it was pretty hard because socially, you know, in the teen band thing in Detroit that was building, the guys could do anything. They had free rein to be in a band or do what they want. There wasn't a lot of girls that we could find to do this with us. So of course it was very, very, you know, it would affect us. Women were thought to be buttoned up and pigeonholed, you know, go to college, settle down, get married, have babies, you know, pursue that life. This was a different thing that we were doing. So of course it became difficult for us to think of losing a member and having to look for someone else. We had to do it. And my dad was always, you know, get back on the horse, just do what you need to do. Nobody's irreplaceable. That was what he always told us every single time that we had a lineup change, and we had them. So we had to do that, you know?
Well, I want to, first of all, I want to talk a lot more about that, but I also think what you said, which was the era this is in. First of all,
Yes.
you're doing rock and roll. There were not a lot of women doing rock and roll. And as you said, the guys had more free rein. There were more male rock and rollers. There just were. You had a larger, pond to pick from. But also within this time, we're talking 1965, as you said, women, there was a certain social, societal expectation for women. And Nan was bucking that by saying, I'm staying in the band even if I go to college.
Yes.
So she, in a way, she was bucking that.
Oh,
But
yeah.
Diane was a little bit more, I don't want to say wishy-washy, but more on the fence, I guess, about it, or maybe not as committed to the pleasure seekers. And she ended up, am I correct? She quit because her boyfriend said, I don't want you spending time with them.
Well, yeah, that happened. We're getting ahead. That happened at Christmas, but she had a boyfriend. You know, he was okay with it, but in a more loose way. You know, I mean, she was going to go to college and leave, and she had all this going on and a boyfriend. So I think she was a little less serious about it, even though she enjoyed it thoroughly. Yeah, I think Nan was the one that was gung ho. Nan, me, and Susie were pretty gung ho about it. Mary Lou was, oh, this is fun, you know. So everybody had a different motivation, I guess, is what I could say.
Well, and you brought up Christmas time with Diane, and yes, I skipped ahead a little bit, but this is also, again, another moment where it's time for the pleasure seekers to finally have your music unveiled. And in November or December, around that time, this is still 1965. And we've talked a little bit about this, but Dave Leone with Punch Andrews, start the Hideout Records label.
Yes.
And so that they can record. They're the homeboys, the teen bands, and you.
Yeah.
So I want to hear the story of how you were even approached with this idea. Was it a given? How did you even hear about it? Tell us.
Well, he just plain out asked us. I mean, by the time he asked us, we had already had to replace Diane. And we got Pris Wenzel because she was in choir, you know, with us. She could play keys. So it was a quick change and she had to learn the repertoire. So she was in the band as Dave asked us. But then
Wait,
come
hold
around.
on, because I think that's important, Patty, and I apologize for stopping you. Because so Pris Wenzel comes in,
Yes.
and but we're talking a very quick turnover. I mean, if
Oh.
right, if school starts in end of September.
Yes. It's a whole mishmash. This whole next 3 to 4 months was a mishmash because we had lineup changes. We had Dave asking us to do a album. I mean, a single. So it was people coming in and out, and what happened, and why that happened, how the parents got involved and stuff. It's very interesting, but a lot happened from September to when the single was finally released on Valentine's Day.
And that Valentine's Day of 1966. So let's not tease this out because you're completely piquing my interest here. Tell
Okay.
us about those few months,
Okay.
and tell us
So,
about who Pris Wenzel is and all of that.
yes, Pris was beautiful, long blonde hair. She was talented. She was so excited to be in. And she came in, she learned her parts. She fit in perfectly. It was fine. Diane was okay with it, you know. And then Dave asked us to do the Hideout songs and two singles that he had a large part in, and we helped him tweak it and stuff when we started rehearsing them. And all of a sudden, Diane comes back at Christmas, and I guess we felt she was more experienced and she wanted to do the record. So she inserted herself. She wasn't rejoining the band, but she was home and she wanted to be on the record. So Pris was let go. And she was not too happy about it. It was a pretty prickly situation. She understood, but it was hard. So Diane came in and did the recording with us, okay?
Well, let's just get back to, as you said, the prickly situation, because I want your take on it. But as an outsider, if I was Pris, I would have been really angry. But that's just me. I don't know. I'm just curious. How did she respond?
Well, I think we had to placate it a little bit. Diane was going to go back to college. So I think we probably would have explained that to her, that it's only fair. Diane was an original. We're going to use her in the recording. It's just fair that we do that. And I think she had to sort of like put up with it, if you want to put it that way. So Diane got to do the recording, and she was going back to college after the holidays. So it turned out okay, but it was a little a prickly.
That's a little prickly, I have to say. But I have a question about then, if Diane comes back at Christmas time, but Dave has already approached the band to do a single, was Pris a part of the writing sessions to do the two songs?
Nope, she was not involved at all. Diane came back, I mean, before Christmas, whenever college ended, and she was there for the entire long holiday, the college break. So she was totally involved in the back room. We did a lot of rehearsing on this in the back, the infamous back room at the Hideout. And then we recorded it at the Quackenbush studio at their house. They had a studio, the Fugitives guys. So yeah, we did the pre-work right at the back room of the Hideout, and Diane was totally involved.
So tell us about the two songs on the single. It's
Okay.
go ahead.
There was no question that Nan was going to sing the Never Thought You'd Leave Me one, which was that was Nan on vocals. She had sort of a sultry voice, and she sang it that way. So there, it was not a question. And then Susie was tapped to do the What a Way to Die one, because it was a lower voice and it was right up Susie's alley. And I mean, we're still 15 and 17 and 18 doing this, the for after the Golden World thing, this was the next one that was going to get released. So
Well, I want to hear a little bit more about Never Thought You'd Leave Me. I personally love this song and I love Nan's vocals on it. I think it should have been a hit, just like What a Way to Die should have been a hit or bigger than it was. But how did it even come about? You co-wrote this with Dave Leone or he wrote it?
He came with the basics. We put in ideas and stuff. It's sort of a group effort, and the arrangement especially, we put all our input into that. And it did get a good reaction. It went over really well, for quite a few months. And then, I mean, we'll get to What a Way to Die, but that was a whole different animal, what happened with that song. But yeah, we all loved the song. Nan did a real good job on it.
Question for you, which I should have asked you when you sang Long White Line, but I'm going to ask you this now. That means that Never Thought You'd Leave Me is your first original, I'm putting air quotes, because you co-wrote it, that you performed live, not just recorded, but that you performed live. Did you ever perform live Long White Line?
No. No,
Interesting.
we didn't. Interesting, huh?
It is interesting.
Yeah.
But you definitely performed Never Thought You'd Leave Me. And
Absolutely.
without further ado, let's let our listeners hear it, and then we will talk about it on the other side. I love it. I love the song so much, but I want to hear from you, Patty, 17-year-old Patty, and now a few decades later, Patty. What do you hear now when you listen to the song, or what memories come up for you when you hear the song?
I just think it was a really nice single. I think Dave did a good job bringing us the basics, and musically we could cope with it. You know, we were good enough by then that it was not a hard song to play or anything. It had some interesting aspects. We were quite happy with it. Yeah, we liked it.
Who came up with, I'm assuming Susie did, but I don't want to assume anything. Who came up with the initial bass line?
Do 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 do. Probably Susie.
It's
Was definitely
incredibly
Susie's
catchy.
idea. Yeah.
I find myself just what you just did often, just humming it.
She picked up bass pretty quick. She worked to learn it, and she did her part, you know, musically to learn the bass. So yeah, she did a good job on it.
So even though she was having fun and bopping around and all her Susie stuff she was doing, she was starting to get serious as well.
Yes, she wanted to not look like a fool. She wanted to do a good job. It mattered to her, yeah, even back then.
Well, speaking of Susie, the B side of this single is What a Way to Die. And as you said, Susie did the vocals on that. And I mean, it's perfection. Her vocals are perfect on it. But it's such a groundbreaking song for so many reasons. I mean, it's the first all-female rock and roll garage band song. It's you are the lyrics, which I want you to read. I don't even want to analyze them because they're incredible. You're all underaged when you're singing these lyrics. And this song has really, I mean, it was so risque when it came out, and it continues to be risque and used in so many different versions of TVs and show, all of that. I mean, it's just really, really had an incredible history all on its own. But I want to go back to when you were recording this for that first time and coming up with the name, What a Way to Die. I mean, how was any of this conceived?
Well, first of all, Mary Lou, our little wild card, she wanted to do all the screams, and she did. And she did them very well. And Susie was going to sing it. And I'm telling you, we thought it was a hoot. It's part of our legacy that we had out the first beer drinking, partying song, girls from the garage. I mean, you know, what an unusual thing to have girls putting out that kind of a song. And as you said, I mean, it's been on TV. It's been on compilations. I can't tell you how many people have covered that stupid song. It has legs that I can't believe. It was in a Levi commercial. It was in indie movies. I mean, it
And
just keeps
continues to
going.
be, continues to be. I mean, Courtney Love from Hole used your song opening her podcast. So, I mean, it's incredible. And so before we listen to it, please read us the lyrics so that when we listen to it.
And Susie sang it with such attitude. She cracked me up. Okay, here we go. Well, I love you, baby. I'm telling you right here. But please don't make me decide, babe, between you and a bottle of beer. But baby, come on over. Come on over to my side. Well, I may not live past 21, but woo, what a way to die. Your loving fluctuates, baby, and everybody knows, but the temperature always stays the same on an ice cold bottle of Stroh's. Well, when I start my drinking, my baby throws a fit, so I just blitz him out of my mind with 16 bottles of Schlitz. You got the kind of body that makes me come alive, but I'd rather have my hand wrapped around a bottle of Colt 45. I mean, girls singing that, and the parents didn't, you know, they didn't say anything about it. The kids loved the song. It overshadowed Never Thought You'd Leave Me eventually because it became so popular at the gigs, and you know, it was going outside of Detroit and stuff. I mean, it was amazing.
It's almost like this is the pleasure seekers version of MC5's Kick Out the Jams.
Yes, it is. It sort of is. Oh my God. hobby. You know, they hadn't gotten onto the idea that this song was out there and it was about beer and drinking and partying. And of course, my parents couldn't give a shit. You know, my dad, he didn't care. You know, he was glad we were doing our passion. He was all for it.